Governor and Mrs. Scass, Excellencies, Lynn Arnold, with thanks for that very generous introduction, Bill Cossey, and Uncle Lewis O'Brien, who's upstaged us all already this evening, ladies and gentlemen. For anyone who came of political age in Australia in the 1960s with any kind of reformist or social justice blood in his veins, Don Dunstan was a hero. He certainly was to me then. He certainly remained so during all my years as a would-be law reformer, although in terms of legislative achievement, I have to say I was much less successful in matching that with ambition than he was. And Don remains a hero of mine to this day. He wasn't a wet finger in the air politician, political leader. He had strong convictions and he pursued them passionately in both opposition and government, seeing even the fiercest opposition as a challenge to be overcome, not a reason for retreat. And every one of Don's core convictions was grounded in manifest human decency. With the issue was criminal justice for Indigenous Australians, police powers, capital punishment, electoral democracy, free speech and association, equal pay, homosexual law reform, or the campaign against apartheid. I think what moved me above all was his hatred of racism in every shape and form. And in that context, above all, his national political leadership with Gough Whitlam of the campaign to bury the disgraceful White Australia policy. With the greatest resistance, of course, coming then from within the ALP itself, from diehards like Arthur Call, who railed that it was only, quote, cranks, long-hairs, academics and do-gooders who wanted change. Well, Arthur may well have been right about that, but in those days, at least, cranks, long-hairs, academics, do-gooders like Don Dunstan was pretty good company to be in. It's wonderful that the Don Dunstan Foundation flourishes to this day, not only keeping alive our memory of the man, but, as has already been said, creating a forum for the principled discussion of the kind of issues on which we know, were he still with us, he would be intensely engaged, both intellectually and emotionally. It's a pleasure and a privilege, then, for me to be giving this address tonight under the auspices not only of the Foundation, but also, of course, Oxfam, not only one of the world's most effective humanitarian agencies, but also, in my direct knowledge, a preeminent intellectual contributor to many of the world's great continuing human rights debates. And it's one of the most important of all those debates, how we should react as an international community to the most grotesque and indefensible of all human rights violations, and in particular the role of international criminal law and justice in that context that I will try to open up with you this evening. As we look back not only at what's been happening in recent months in Syria, but over recent decades, and indeed over the whole course of human history, one of the most depressing and distressing realities we have to acknowledge has been our apparently congenital inability to prevent or halt the apparently endlessly recurring horror of mass atrocity crimes. The murder, torture, rape, starvation, expulsion, destruction of property and life opportunities of others, for no other reason than their race, ethnicity, religion, nationality, caste, class, ideology, or opinion. What in some ways is hardest of all to believe is how little changed in the decades after World War II. One might have thought that Hitler's atrocities within Germany and in the states under Nazi occupation would have laid to rest once and for all the notion, predominant in international law and practice since the emergence of modern nation states back in the 17th century, that what happened within state borders was nobody else's business. To put it starkly, that sovereignty was essentially a license to kill. But even with all the developments in international human rights law and international humanitarian law which followed the Second World War, even with the Nuremberg Tribunal Charter and the recognition of crimes against humanity, which could be committed by a government against its own people. Even with the recognition of individual and group rights in the UN Charter itself, the Declaration of Human Rights and the subsequent international covenants, even with the new Geneva Conventions taking forward international humanitarian law on the protection of civilians, and even after the Genocide Convention, signed in 1948, aimed at preventing and punishing the worst of all crimes against humanity, attempting to destroy whole groups simply on the basis of their race, ethnicity, religion, or nationality, even after all those developments, the killing still went on. Why didn't things fundamentally change? Well, essentially, it was because the overwhelming preoccupation of those who founded the UN and founded the post-war international order was not, in fact, human rights, but rather the problem of states waging aggressive war against each other. What actually captured the mood of the time, and that which prevailed really right through during the Cold War years, was more than any of the human rights provisions to which I referred, Article 2.7 of the UN Charter, which said that, quote, nothing should authorise intervention in matters essentially within the domestic jurisdiction of any state. The state of mind that even massive atrocity crimes like those of the Cambodian killing fields were just not the rest of the world's business was actually dominant throughout the UN's first half century of existence. Vietnam's invasion of Cambodia in 1978, which stopped the Khmer Rouge in its tracks, was universally attacked as a violation of state sovereignty, not applauded. Tanzania had to justify its overthrow of Uganda's Idi Amin in 1979 by invoking self-defense, not any larger human rights justification. And the same had been true of India's intervention in East Pakistan against the murderous onslaught of West Pakistan troops there in 1971. With the arrival of the 1990s and the end of the Cold War, the prevailing complacent assumptions about non-intervention did at least come under challenge as never before. The quintessential peace and security problem before 9/11 came along to change the focus yet again to terrorism became not interstate war but civil war and internal violence perpetrated on a massive scale. With the breakup of various Cold War state structures and the removal of some superpower constraints, conscience-shocking situations repeatedly arose, above all, you'll remember, in the former Yugoslavia and in Africa. But old habits of non-intervention still died very hard. Even when situations cried out for some kind of response, and even when the community, international community did react through the UN, it was too often erratically, incompletely, or counterproductively, as in the debacle in Somalia in 93, the catastrophe of the Rwandan genocide in 94, in which 800,000 people were butchered in the space of just a few short weeks, and again in the almost unbelievable default in Srebrenica in Bosnia just a year later in 1995, when you'll remember 8,000 men and boys were led out of a so-called UN safe haven under the noses of international peacekeepers and shot to death in neighbouring fields. Then the killing and the ethnic cleansing, you remember, started all over again in Kosovo in 1999. Not everyone, but certainly most people around the world, most governments, accepted quite rapidly that external military intervention was the only way to stop that. But again, the Security Council failed to act, this time in the face of a threatened veto by Russia, an unhappily familiar story again in the last year over Syria, as I'll come back to later on. The action that needed to be taken in Kosovo was eventually taken by a coalition of the willing, but without the authority of the Security Council, thus challenging the integrity of the whole international security system, just as did the invasion of Iraq 4 years later in far less defensible circumstances. Part of the institutional problem, the absence of international courts and tribunals with the jurisdiction and the resources to try and punish those accused of major crimes against humanity and war crimes, has been remedied in recent years. There have been some significant applications, for example, of the exercise within national court systems of universal jurisdiction, with most famously, I guess, the example being the prosecution and conviction across the road from me in Brussels when I was there in 2001, of the Rwandan nuns charged with complicity in the Rwandan genocide. There's been the development of a number of specialist national courts with international assistance, like the Special Court for Sierra Leone, which has just, in the last few weeks, convicted and imprisoned Charles Taylor, and the Cambodian Tribunal, now trying three of the most senior Khmer Rouge cadres still alive, including Khieu Samphan, one of my key interlocutors when I was negotiating the Cambodia peace process in the late 1980s. And to see him before a court is a consummation profoundly to be wished, I can tell you. There's been the establishment, following the example of the Nuremberg Military Tribunal, of specialist tribunals to deal with war crimes committed in specific conflicts, in particular former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. And by far most importantly, there's been the establishment by treaty, the Rome Statute of 1998, of the International Criminal Court. Setting up a permanent court to hear cases of genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes, with no time limitation on its ability to prosecute. Criminal Court, the ICC, has jurisdiction where a crime is alleged to have taken place on the territory of a state party to the statute, where the accused is a national of a state party, where a country has specifically accepted the court's jurisdiction, and, most relevantly in most of these cases, where a case has been referred to the International Criminal Court by the UN Security Council. But the trouble is that all international law, as much as it pains international lawyers to confront this reality, is ultimately politics. International courts and tribunals don't get established and resourced without political commitment. States don't become party to them without political decisions, of the kind for which the United States, for one, has still found impossible to make when it comes to adhering to the International Criminal Court Charter. Cases don't get referred by a state party or the Security Council without political decision. With no international marshals services, indictees can't be arrested and transferred to the courts without the cooperation of relevant states. Court decisions rely wholly on individual states for their implementation. All of which means that while the international courts and tribunals and other legal strategies, some of which I'll mention in a moment, are important elements in the mass atrocity prevention and reaction toolbox, whether those tools are actually applied depends on political will. It depends on international consensus about the relevant norms and international cooperation in applying them. And it's that element of political will and the practical cooperation which it makes possible which has been profoundly lacking, not just for decades, but centuries, in the case of mass atrocity crimes. But we now, in the last decade, have in fact taken a giant stride forward in addressing that question of political will, with the birth and the evolution of the new principle of the responsibility to protect, R2P, if you like, for short. I don't pretend for a moment that we've yet solved the problem of mass atrocity crimes once and for all, even though the subtitle of my book out there is Ending Mass Atrocity Crimes Once and for All. I don't pretend we've solved it. How could I, in the face of the totally unresolved mess in Syria right now? And there are innumerable implementation problems that will continue to arise every time the principle is invoked, some of which I'll come to later in this talk, like the peace versus justice dilemma. But the reality is that we are now closer to consensus on the nature and extent of the international responsibility to respond to these crimes than we have ever been. And I think it's a story worth briefly telling. The responsibility to protect principle was born out of that series of conscience-shocking cases in the 90s, in the Balkans and Africa, to which I've already referred, which produced not consensus, but fierce doctrinal and essentially ideological argument. On the one hand, there were advocates, mostly in the global north, of humanitarian intervention. The doctrine that there was a right to intervene, droit d'ingérence, as Bernard Kouchner, the Frenchman who invented this, insisted, a right to intervene militarily against the will of the government of the country in question in these cases. On the other hand, there were defenders of the traditional prerogatives of state sovereignty, who made the familiar case that internal events were just none of the rest of the world's business. And this was very much, unhappily, a North-South debate, with, in the South, the many new states born out of decolonisation over recent decades being very proud of their new one sovereignty, very conscious in many cases of their fragility, all too conscious in most cases of the way in which they'd been on the receiving end in the past of not very benign interventions from the imperial and colonial powers, and not very keen as a result to acknowledge their right to do so again, whatever the circumstances. So this gulf opened up UN General Assembly debates worldwide. It was a fierce argument and absolutely a consensus-free zone. This was the environment which led then Kofi Annan, Secretary General of the UN, to issue what became a quite famous challenge to the General Assembly in 2000. If, he said, humanitarian intervention is indeed an unacceptable assault on sovereignty, how then should we respond to a Rwanda, to a Srebrenica, to gross and systematic violations of human rights that offend every precept of our common humanity? It was a question that demanded an answer, and it was this challenge to which the Canadian government responded by appointing the International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty, which I was asked to co-chair with a very distinguished African diplomat. In its 2001 report, entitled Responsibility to Protect, the Commission came up with that idea, that concept, which took the whole debate in a new and what's now acknowledged to be much more productive direction. The report did so, in three main ways. Changed the debate in three main ways. First, presentationally, by changing the language of the debate, turning the right to intervene into the responsibility to protect, recharacterising the issue, in other words, as not being about the right of any state, particularly large and powerful ones, to throw their weight around militarily, but rather the responsibility of all states to act to protect their own and other men, women and children at risk of suffering from mass atrocity crimes. Some people say, well, that was just a linguistic shift, but it was a very important one, as important in its own way, I think, as a few years earlier, the linguistic shift that was accomplished with the invention of the expression sustainable development by the Gro-Brundtland Commission, designed to try and bridge the gap between environmentalists and developers, which was then as huge as the one between North and South over atrocity crimes that I've been talking about. The second big thing the Commission report did conceptually was broaden the range of actors in the frame, whereas the right to intervene, whereas humanitarian intervention language focused just on the international response by those capable and willing to apply military force. The new formulation spread the responsibility. Responsibility to protect formula started by recognising and insisting upon the responsibility of each sovereign state itself to protect its people from harm. It moved from there to identify the responsibility of other states to assist them if they were having difficulty in achieving that result and if they're in a mood to be assisted. And only then, if a state was manifestly failing as a result of either incapacity or ill will to protect its own people, only then did the responsibility shift to the wider international community to respond more robustly. The third thing the Commission report did was to dramatically broaden the range of appropriate responses to these situations. Whereas the right to intervene or humanitarian intervention focused very one-dimensionally just on military reaction, responsibility to protect, as it was articulated in the Commission report, involves multiple elements in the response continuum, starting with preventive action, both long and short term, moving to reaction when prevention fails, and then moving to post-crisis responsibility to rebuild a society crushed by one of these events, aimed again at prevention, but this time prevention of recurrence of the whole ugly cycle of violence. Moreover, the reaction element in the middle was itself a nuanced continuum, beginning with persuasion, moving from there to non-military forms of pressure, like coercion, if you like, like sanctions or the threat of international criminal prosecution, and then only as an absolute last resort, after multiple criteria were satisfied, coercive military force. So articulated in this way, as a much more complex and nuanced concept with a different label to go with it, responsibility to protect had an extraordinarily rapid take-up, almost unprecedented, in fact, in the history of ideas. Its evolution is a long and complicated story. It's already the subject of scores, maybe hundreds of PhDs, with many more in the pipeline. I know, because most of the candidates around the world seem to have chased me for interviews on the subject. But the milestones in the evolution of the doctrine, I think, can be fairly quickly described. And again, it's perhaps worth quickly doing so. Within 4 years after the Commission's report, in 2005, after some very intense and sustained diplomacy in multiple forums, the core elements of this concept were unanimously endorsed by the more than 150 heads of state and government meeting as the UN General Assembly at the World Summit, celebrating the 60th anniversary of the UN. It was made clear in the summit document, made clear beyond doubt, that genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, crimes against humanity were not, in short, no one else's business, but rather everyone's business. And within another year after the General Assembly resolution, the concept had been embraced in a specific resolution, formal Security Council resolution. These formal statements were in themselves rather breathtaking achievements, since what was involved here conceptually was nothing less than, as the British historian Martin Gilbert put it at the time, the most significant adjustment to national sovereignty in 360 years. But words on UN paper are one thing. Implementation is something else. The next 5 years, from 2005 through to the end of 2010, which I think of as R2P's Responsibility Protects adolescence period, saw not, frankly, a great deal of effective action, but a lot of tortured argument about the scope and limits of the doctrine, whether and how it should apply in cases like Darfur, the Congo, Sri Lanka, the general's response, the tardy response to the cyclone in Myanmar, Russia's invasion, very cynical invasion of South Ossetia in Georgia. But despite that protracted debate and agonising debate that continued to go on in that period, efforts made in the General Assembly during this period by a number of spoiler countries, notably Nicaragua, Venezuela, Cuba, Sudan, efforts made to turn back the clock and overturn the 2005 consensus were rebuffed. And there are also some clear-cut practical success stories. Most of all, in Kenya in early 2008, where I guess most of you remember, in the context of a Rwanda-like explosion of ethnic-focused violence in the aftermath of a contested election, and with a major genocide seriously feared, a diplomatic mission led by Kofi Annan under the auspices of both the UN and the African Union, explicitly invoking the responsibility to protect concept, successfully defused the situation, demonstrating in the process that even in the most extreme cases, responsibility to protect was not just about military intervention. It was not just old humanitarian intervention, wine in a new bottle, but something quite different. It was not until last year, 2011, that the UN Security Council itself took action explicitly under the responsibility to protect banner. When it did so, in the cases of Cote d'Ivoire and Libya, this was widely heralded, including by me, as the coming of age of the responsibility to protect. And Libya especially, in February, March last year was a textbook example of the way that Responsibility Protect is supposed to work in the face of a rapidly unfolding mass atrocity situation, during which early stage, indeed even late stage, prevention measures no longer have any relevance, when you've got to do something more. What happened, you remember, in February last year, Gaddafi's forces responded to the initially very peaceful protests against the excesses of his regime, inspired by the Arab Spring revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt, responded by massacring at least several hundred of his own people. And that led to the unanimous UN Security Council Resolution 1970-1970, which specifically invoked the Libyan authorities' responsibility to protect its population, condemned its violence against civilians, demanded that it stop, and sought to concentrate Gaddafi's mind by applying targeted sanctions, an arms embargo, and the threat of International Criminal Court prosecution for crimes against humanity. Well, that was the first instalment. But as it became apparent that Gaddafi was not only ignoring that resolution, but planning a major assault, you remember, on the city of Benghazi, in which he was saying no mercy or pity would be shown to perceived opponents, armed or otherwise, his reference to cockroaches having a specific resonance for those who remembered how Tutsis were being described before the 1994 genocide in Rwanda. In the face of all this, the Security Council followed up with Resolution 1973, also specifically invoking the responsibility to protect concept, which by majority vote, with no Russian, no Chinese veto, or any other dissenting voices, explicitly authorised, quote, all necessary measures, which in UN speak means military intervention, quote, to protect civilians and civilian populated areas under threat of attack. And acting under that authorization, NATO-led forces took immediate action. The feared massacres did not eventuate. If the Security Council had acted equally decisively, equally robustly in the 1990s, the 8,000 murdered in Srebrenica, the 800,000 murdered in Rwanda might still be alive today. But with the apparent maturity of R2P also came a midlife crisis. As the weeks and months of the Libyan intervention wore on, the Western-led military enterprise came under fierce attack by the so-called BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, came under attack for exceeding its narrow civilian protection mandate. You remember the language was protection of civilians and civilian populated areas. For exceeding the mandate, by being content, it became apparent that intervention with nothing less than full-blown regime change, the ouster of Gaddafi. The merits of the argument running each way are pretty finely balanced. There's much to be said both for those who say, as the Western interveners did, that all-out war against the Gaddafi regime was the only way to protect Libyans from violation of their right to life, and those who insist still that diplomatic solutions should have continued to be explored and insist that the Security Council should have been given a serious opportunity to reconsider the scope of its mandate as events evolved. For present purposes, the most important result of this continuing dispute and all the distrust that it engendered has been its impact on the Security Council's response to Syria, where the one-sided violence by the regime was, by the middle of last year, manifestly worse even than that which had triggered the Libyan intervention. In the face of threatened vetoes from Russia and China and continuing unhappiness by the other members of the BRICS group, the Council found itself for a very long time unable to agree even on a formal condemnatory motion, and it's now as far away as ever from agreeing on more robust measures like sanctions and arms embargo or the threat of international criminal prosecution. No one has made any kind of a compelling case that the responsibility to protect doctrine applied to Syria in the present circumstances, demands coercive military intervention. A whole multitude of reasons for that. Basically, it comes down to the fact that the cost-benefit calculation is very different to that which applied in Libya. But the paralysis of the Council, when it's come to putting any other pressure on the Assad regime, has unquestionably strengthened Assad's hand immeasurably. We now have a situation which has been, as feared, deteriorating into full-scale civil war, with no evident solution in sight other than a possible diplomatic one, should Russia finally decide to lend its weight to the process, persuading enough senior officials in the Syrian regime to change course with enough safe exits for the most divisive figures to enable the situation to stabilise and reform to start. Maybe news overnight, last night, about some promising exchanges by Kofi Annan in Damascus, and more significantly still, Russia's apparent decision to stop, for the time being anyway, further arms sales to the Syrian regime. Maybe that signals that some move of this kind is at last seriously going to begin. But we certainly shouldn't be holding our breath. As former United States National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft said last month, just because there's a problem doesn't mean there's a solution. That said, just as any celebration about the triumph of the responsibility to protect principle would have been totally premature after the Libyan resolutions, for all the reasons I've just described, so too would be premature despair now about the future of the responsibility to protect. Nobody suggests that the geopolitics of ensuring effective civilian protection is ever going to be easy, especially in cases where early stage prevention, if any, has manifestly failed. What has to be accepted and treated as a challenge rather than a cause for despair is that there's always going to be tough debate about what to do in the really hard cases, where the violations that are occurring are so extreme that the question of coercive military force comes into play as something which, prima facie at least, has to be seriously contemplated and may be the only way to halt or avert the harm that's occurring or feared. The truth of the matter is that the higher the stakes, the higher the emotion, and the more that realpolitik will come into play. But what we do know on the evidence of the major debates on the responsibility to protect that have taken place in the UN General Assembly in each of the last 3 years is that even at the height of the concern last year about the claimed overreach of the Security Council's mandate in Libya, the overwhelming majority of UN member states remain fully supportive of the new norm. They made that abundantly clear in their contributions to those debates. So much so that Secretary General Ban Ki-moon felt able to say last September, our debates, quote, are about how, not whether, to implement the responsibility to protect. No government questions the principle. Well, what's the role of law and justice in all of this? When it comes to how to implement responsibility to protect in particular cases, where does law fit in? There are a number of ways in which law and lawyers and legal institutions can, in fact, advance responsibility to protect and help end mass atrocity crimes at the preventive stage and right through thereafter. In the prevention tray of the toolbox, there are long-term measures like promoting fair constitutional structures, promoting human rights protections and the rule of law, fighting corruption. The more immediate parts of the toolbox tray, legal dispute resolution, and, of course, the threat of international criminal prosecution. In the reaction tray of the toolbox, there's the actual initiation of criminal prosecution, and in the post-crisis rebuilding compartment, there are measures like rebuilding the criminal justice system, managing transitional justice, and where appropriate, supporting traditional justice. For most of these sorts of measures and strategies, no particular problems arise other than finding the will and the resources to manage their successful implementation. But there's one particular measure, the initiation of international criminal proceedings that does often generate a very real, a very significant real-world dilemma, particularly given the large range of atrocity crimes that are now within the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. And this is the peace versus justice problem. Should the demands of justice to bring an end once and for all to the almost universal impunity that has prevailed in relation to these crimes in the past, and to create an effective deterrent to their commission in the future, should justice ever yield in the case of a clash between them to the demands of peace, namely to bring a quick end to some conflict that has wreaked untold destruction and misery until then, and which may continue to do so if a peace agreement can't be negotiated? This is an issue which has arisen in recent times with the threatened or actual indictments of Sudan's President Bashir, the Ugandan Lord's Revolutionary Army's Joseph Kony, Libya's President Gaddafi. It's risen again now with various demands for the prosecution of President Bashar Assad of Syria, and it can be expected to arise many times more in the future. Despite the position which tends to be taken quite reflexively by human rights lawyers and advocates, that peace without justice is no peace at all, that nothing is ever really lost and much is to be gained by ensuring that there's never any impunity, my own experience is unquestionably that these demands do clash from time to time. Hard choices do have to be made. Above all, the problem arises when there's an ongoing conflict and a peace negotiation is attempting to reach agreement between parties capable of perpetuating that crisis. It's not nearly such an issue when one side or another has actually been clearly defeated, or has been, for all practical purposes, defeated and is trying to negotiate the terms of a surrender. Ongoing conflicts create, posed by comparison, a real-world policy dilemma, which I experienced in acute form on a number of occasions when I was president of the International Crisis Group. A human rights lawyer, as I am, by training and instinct, but one very much in the business of conflict prevention and resolution. No case for me raised the dilemma more sharply than that of Charles Taylor, that murderous former president of Liberia who left a trail of human rights wreckage behind him in the civil wars in that country in Sierra Leone around the turn of the century, a dozen years ago. With thousands more deaths feared if his threatened final assault on the Liberian capital of Monrovia had proceeded in 2003, it was not unreasonable from a conflict prevention perspective for Nigeria to forestall that by offering him asylum, which was readily accepted, brought the conflict to a conclusion, avoided a massacre. But was it reasonable for Nigeria to then succumb 3 years later to a huge amount of international pressure to hand Taylor over through Liberia to be tried in the Sierra Leone court, which I've already mentioned, without actually producing any evidence that he'd breached the conditions of his asylum? The understandable joy that handover, that prosecution generated among human rights lawyers around the world should, I think, be tempered by the appreciation that this sent a very unhelpful message to some other serial human rights violators who might otherwise have been tempted to end their depredations in return for a safe haven and a soft landing. Certainly one of them I know personally was Zimbabwe's Robert Mugabe, and perhaps Syria's President Assad is now another. I think one can work through the dilemma of whether to ever preference peace over justice by having regard to three important principles that must govern any such decision. The first is that justice is and must be the default position, and that it's only in the most exceptional cases where the evidence really is clear that very major peace benefits are involved should serious consideration be given to discontinuing investigations underway or granting formal amnesties. The second principle is that if decisions to give primacy to peace over justice do have to be made in certain hard cases, those decisions are best made not by the International Criminal Court or its prosecutor, but by those with appropriate political responsibility. In the case of the International Criminal Court, the Security Council, the UN Security Council, actually has that power, if it chooses, to use Article 16 of the Rome Statute, which enables it to suspend prosecutions for renewable periods of 12 months over and over again, in effect indefinitely. The prosecutor's job in these situations is to prosecute. He should get on with it, with bulldog intensity. However difficult it may well prove to be in practice to get the Security Council to make a suspension decision, if such a decision has to be made, the kind of trade-off reasons that I've identified, it's a political one, and the pressure and the weight of expectations should be taken off a prosecutor's shoulder in this respect. And the third relevant principle, I for one strongly believe, is that deals made in good faith should be fully honoured. One simply can't have it both ways, granting asylum to secure peace, then overturning the asylum to secure a conviction. Or perhaps more precisely, one can have it both ways, but not if one hopes to be ever able to make such deals again in the future in cases that may actually justify them. A variation of the peace and justice problem, which I'll conclude, is the case of ongoing, a variation of the peace and justice problem in the case of ongoing conflicts is the issue of accountability versus reconciliation in the case of conflicts that are not ongoing but have reached some stage of resolution. There's exactly the same potential for human rights advocates to take the position that justice must be pursued come what may. And there is, in my view, exactly the same need in practice to make careful case-by-case judgments based on the characteristics of each particular situation. In post-conflict societies like Libya right now, trying to rebuild themselves after mass atrocity crimes have been committed, often, as in the case of Rwanda, by very large numbers of people, not just isolated psychopaths. In these cases, both national leaders and internationals trying to advise and assist them face hugely difficult dilemmas in deciding how, on the one hand, to ensure accountability for those crimes, but on the other hand, somehow to achieve social reconciliation. In one given society, investigations of mass murder and prosecutions of those responsible for it in national, international, or hybrid courts may well be thought to contribute to a sense of political catharsis that cleans the air, relaxes tensions, opens the door to restorative justice. But in another case, it may be seen as increasing instability and deepening hostility among adversarial groups. Mozambique and Namibia are among many examples where reconciliation was pursued to the almost complete exclusion of any accountability at all. Between the polar extremes of emphasising retributive justice through trial and punishment and hoping that somehow time itself will be sufficient to heal the wounds and memories of past atrocities, on the other hand, there lie several other options, a number of them combining elements of both approaches. Let me quickly run through them. One is simply postponement, delaying the day of reckoning, as essentially Chile and Argentina did, and to some extent also Cambodia. Maybe a Libya now will, until the society was felt to be strong and cohesive enough to face its past and itself impose accountability for those crimes without fear of destabilizing consequences. A second approach is the barring of a whole class of individuals from public employment, political participation, and the enjoyment of other civil rights, so-called lustration, as with denazification in Germany, demilitarization in Japan, for both of which there was an administrative appeal apparatus, and de-Ba'athification in Iraq, where there was no such process. This can actually work in cases where the class in question is clearly defined and comprehensively discredited, with its members all evidently sharing some moral responsibility. But it really does tend to be counterproductive, generating resentment and resistance, as in the case of Iraq, where these conditions are not met. The third option, and the one that's been generating some lively but so far unresolved debate in Libya right now, is some kind of truth Commission, or Truth and Reconciliation Commission. In their pure form, such commissions are premised on the notion of fixing responsibility without attendant punishment, in effect offering amnesty in return for full disclosure, thus addressing key accountability objectives such as truth-telling and the delegitimisation of state-sponsored violence. In the familiar South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, there was a heavy additional emphasis on forgiveness as a key to reconciliation, less in practice on the truth for amnesty trade-off. In fact, almost no very senior figures from the apartheid regime, either side, appeared, nor any prosecuted for their failure to do so, evidently because such prosecutions could have derailed the fragile transition. Truth commissions and court processes can also be seen to be complementing each other rather than being somehow in competition. In Argentina, the significant amounts of information produced by the Truth Commission, established back in 83, were then utilised by the authorities in prosecuting members of the military junta that had ruled the country. In Sierra Leone, both a Truth Commission and a special court were established, and they were held simultaneously for quite a time. So certainly trials as well as truth commissions may be pictured as vehicles of emotional expression, cathartic transformation, enabling expression of the community's abhorrence of the atrocities committed and placating the desire of victims for vengeance. If you can somehow marry the two, that's possibly the best of all possible outcomes. The fourth option is to provide reparations to victims of human rights violations, which might be either substantive, compensatory, restitutive, or symbolic. Restitutive example, most often cited and frequently touted as a success, is of the Canadians and Americans of Japanese descent who were interned during the Second World War. I think a good example of the symbolic approach is much closer to home, the apology offered to the Indigenous peoples of Australia on behalf of all Australians by Prime Minister Kevin Rudd in 2008. Finally, the fifth option for dealing with post-conflict accountability and reconciliation issues is to rely on traditional justice mechanisms, informal, tribal, local, grassroots, village-level justice systems like the Gacaca process in Rwanda that owe nothing to European-derived state-level justice systems. There are downside risks with this and many other such traditional justice mechanisms, not least in sometimes reinforcing modes of governance that have been among the original causes of the conflict. But here as elsewhere, well-intentioned outsiders are best to shut up, best to recognise that it must ultimately be a matter for the people of the distressed country itself to decide which and what combination they choose. Well, it is impossible to offer a definitive one solution answer to the dilemmas that I've been describing. There just often are inherent tensions and agonising choices involved between the demands of justice and those of peace, and the demands of accountability, the demands of reconciliation. Just as there are and always have been famously tensions between justice and equality, or freedom and equality, and other competing pairs of moral principles. The only way through the morass, I believe, I repeat, is to treat justice, accountability, and non-impunity as the default positions, but to recognise that they are just that, not absolute, and that in the real world cases will arise where the arguments for making exceptions really are compelling. Human rights advocates shouldn't feel that they're letting the side down if they accept that. Those in the conflict prevention and resolution business, and those in the business of hunting down and punishing the guilty, all of us ultimately want the same thing: an end to violent conflict, an end to the horror and the misery, war and mass atrocity crimes, and to ensure the dignity and common humanity of our fellow human beings. The great new organising principle that has united the international community as never before in responding to genocide and other mass atrocity crimes is and remains the responsibility to protect. The completely effective implementation, responsibility to protect, is going to be work in progress for some time yet, that's for sure. renewed consensus on how to implement it in the hardest cases in future, those like Syria, is going to be very hard to achieve. But I don't think there is any policy maker in the world who fails to understand that the alternative to Security Council cooperation on these matters is a return to the bad old days of Rwanda, Srebrenica, and Kosovo. Either total inaction in the face of mass atrocity crimes, or action, but that which is outlawed by the UN Charter in defiance of every principle of a rule-based international order. After all that's been achieved over the last decade, that would be heartbreaking. But invoking, as I do at the end of this address as at the beginning, the ever forward-looking and upbeat shade of Don Dunstan, I'm optimistic enough to believe that that won't happen. Thank you.